The Legal Corner Podcast Series. Welcome to today's episode of The Legal Corner, a podcast which covers a variety of legal issues to keep you informed. Hosted by attorney at law Colin Dinoon and communication specialist Leonardo Torres.
It's good to be with you once more on the Legal Corner Podcast Series as we begin our second season. Leonardo is currently on vacation, and I hope that he's having a great time. I know I wasn't with you all at the last episode, but Leonardo did an excellent job when he spoke to the former senior magistrate about her life on and off the bench. Now, in today's episode, we'll be looking at the role and function of the president. The Electoral College recently elected Mrs. Christine Kangalo as the 7th President of the Republic of Trinidad and Tobago. She received her instrument of appointment this week and will be officially sworn in on March 21st, 2023. There has been public discussion about the role of the president and whether that office is still relevant in today's society. Joining me on the show today to provide some perspective on this is Mr. Vaughan Thomas, attorney at law. Just to tell you a bit about him, Vaughan M. Thomas is an attorney at law in Trinidad and Tobago. He has served as a tutor in constitutional law for almost 7 years. He has also served as an adjunct lecturer at the UWE Open Campus in civil procedures, trust, constitutional and administrative law. In addition to his practice of law and commitment to legal education, Mr. Thomas is also a certified anti-money laundering and financial crime professional and a member of the Association of Compliance Professionals of Trinidad and Tobago. His top research areas include public law and human rights, property law, fraud, and privacy. Mr. Thomas also wrote a great article on the subject of the presidency, and I'll drop it, a link to it in the show notes. Good day to you, Vaughan, and welcome to the Legal Corner.
Good day, Colin, and it's indeed a great pleasure to be here. I've listened to some of your prior episodes, and it is indeed a pleasure for me to be here. And I indeed feel honored that you would invite me on to shed some light on this very important issue about the election and the role and functions of a president.
Thank you very much. Now let's jump right into it, Vaughan. Tell us, how is the president elected?
Okay. Well, the president is elected by the Electoral College. And the Electoral College is made up of all the members of the House of Representatives, which is 41 MPs, plus the Speaker, which is 42, and the Senate, all members of the Senate, 31 members in the Senate, including the President and the Senate. They sit together with the Speaker presiding over the Electoral College. Every member would have a single vote, including the Speaker and the President of the Senate. So that gives you a total of about 42, add 31, about 73 members in total. So the president is elected by a majority of that total figure. So based on the composition of the House and the Senate, there will be a built-in majority of sorts for the government of the day. Because by virtue of the fact that you are the government, you had to have a majority of seats in the House of Representatives, and you have the choice of the Speaker. And as the government, you also have 16 senators in the Senate, whereas the opposition would have a minority of seats in the House of Representatives and only 6 senators in the Senate. So in the Electoral College, there's that built-in advantage to the government of the day.
Yes. Now, based on what you said, I'm wondering if it is time to change that procedure, given that It begs the question, is an election necessary, seeing that the government already has a built-in majority?
Well, two considerations here. One is that the voting is by secret ballot. So there isn't a question of, remember, the government MPs support the government's initiatives by virtue of the party whip. So if an MP decides to break the line, so to speak, and vote against the government can actually, under Section 49 of the Constitution, declare their seat vacant and dismiss them from the House. But in the election of a president, you have voting by secret ballot. So the party whip doesn't know who, if any, government MPs would support an opposing candidate, for example. And the Prime Minister himself gave the example in 1997, I think 97 or 98, with the election of A.N.R. Robinson as president, where he broke ranks with his party and supported President Robinson, who was the UNC's nominee in that election. So it's not a given that the government will have its way all the time. And secondly, okay, when we come, and I know that we'll talk about that later on, is that, is it really desirable to have a separate election for president? So I know there is some conversation that takes place in the public domain that, okay, how democratic is it that we have a president who is not elected popularly by the people? So we have to ask, do you think that the nation, we know what happens during an election year, whether it's a local government election or a general election for the House of Representatives. We know the anxiety that is in the public domain. We know the upheaval that takes place. So is it really desirable that we have a president elected popularly by the people in the current constitutional framework?
That would definitely be good food for thought. Right? Tell us a bit about the constitutional requirements for someone to be considered as a nominee.
Okay. The Constitution is set up with only two qualifications to be president, but a number of disqualifications. So the two qualifications are that it must be someone 35 years or more. So it's an age requirement, and the person must have been ordinarily resident in the country, in Trinidad and Tobago, for the past 10 years. Well, I think the language of the Constitution is 10 years immediately preceding the nomination. What does ordinarily resident mean? That is to say that you really, that you have been living in Trinidad for the past 10 years. It doesn't take into account you go on vacation, you spend a couple months in another country, but you should be living and working in Trinidad to be considered to be ordinarily resident here. Disqualifications. The Constitution doesn't spell out a separate list for the president. What the Constitution does, and quite curiously, is that it says that a person is disqualified from being president if he or she is also disqualified from serving in Parliament. And the Constitution refers you to Section 48.1 and 2. And 48.1 really sets out a list of the persons who cannot stand for election to Parliament in Trinidad. And that is someone who is a dual citizen, for example. Someone who is a bankrupt. Someone who has a mental disability. If there's legislation that disqualifies, separate legislation outside of the Constitution, which disqualifies someone from membership in the House, if that legislation applies to the candidate for president, then that person is disqualified. Also, you have things like if you are under a sentence of death, for example, you can't be president. So the disqualifications rarely go to the character of the person. That is whether or not they are their citizenship, whether or not they're bankrupt, that kind of thing. So I know that, and this is what prompted me to write when I wrote the op-ed on the office of the president, because I felt that there was a bit of confusion in the public domain that a requirement for election was neutrality, in the sense that you should not be associated in any way with any party. And that is not the case. And if you look at the Constitution at Section 24, it says that where a member of the Senate or the House is elected president, his seat in the Senate or the House shall thereupon become vacant. So on the face of it, by the words of the Constitution itself, for those persons who want to interpret the Constitution literally, and you must do so when the Constitution is clear, it does envisage that someone who is a sitting member of parliament can become the president. So I know that might come as a shock to some people, but the law is what the law is.
Of course, because in this present incarnation here, there was a lot of discussion given that the president-elect was the former president of the Senate, and in fact, she was a government minister and an MP. So there was some discussion. Of course, she was in those positions in the past, so there was some discussion as it related to neutrality, right? So I'm glad that you clarified that there is no actual requirement within the Constitution that someone be apolitical or not a member of a political party.
And I would add, Colin, that we have to always bear in mind that we are not electing a judge, for example. You would expect the judge to be to not have any association with any active association with any political party or something, because the judge is expected to be and should be seen to be impartial. The president is an executive office. It's not a judicial office. So there cannot be a requirement that the person not have any association with any party, because the result may be that you find nobody who could be president.
Yeah, such a requirement would be unrealistic, especially in a small society as ours.
Yeah, and I find it quite paradoxical that persons say, look, we want the president has to be neutral. But on the other hand, they say, well, we should elect a president popularly. If you're electing the president popularly, what is keeping the political parties out of it? What is keeping the politics out of it? So we have to bear that in mind. And also, the Constitution must be read in such a way that it is not that the person, although it might be ideal that, okay, we select somebody who has the least political, has an image that is not political. That might be ideal, but the Constitution doesn't envisage that. What the Constitution does is that it ensures that whoever is elected, it could be a sitting MP, it could be a sitting Prime Minister who is elected as president, but when they enter into the office, they become independent. And they become independent because of the security of tenure that you give the office of president. So there is no need, I could be the strongest party supporter. When I am elected, there is very little room for my party leader to tell me, I will dismiss you as president if you don't do what I say.
Right, because that's one of the things we're going to be discussing later on in terms of removal and how we're going to, what is the procedure for removing the president. What I wanted to tell us about the term of office. How long is a president in office for?
The president is in office for a term of 5 years. It's a fixed term. It cannot be cut short by anyone except if the president resigns or if the president is removed in accordance with the procedure that the Constitution sets out. So it's a fixed term.
Now, what would you say are the most important functions of the president?
Okay. It might be cliche for me to say that everything the president does is important. But we have to understand the president's role, not in comparison to what the prime minister does. So when we are analyzing the importance of the office and the importance of the duties that the president exercises, we must realize that this is a separate office that exists for a purpose separate to that of the prime minister. We know the prime minister is a very powerful figure. And I will start by referring to Section 74 of the Constitution, which vests in the president all the executive power in Trinidad and Tobago, as well as supreme command of the military and the armed forces in the president. But then it goes on to say that things like the general direction and control of the country, that is the day-to-day management of the country, belongs to the prime minister. So that's why you will see matters that concern the day-to-day function of the office. We see that the president acts on the advice of the prime minister. But that is not the full core of duties that a president performs. Because the president now has to make a series of very critical appointments, which we take for granted. Because, Colin, we say a lot of things about the political directorate, but we feel confident that if we take a matter to court for redress, that we will be treated fairly. We are confident that no government of the day can tell a school teacher or tell a public servant that if you do not do what my party wants, that you're going to lose your job. We know that no government can tell the police, if this person, if I know that people in constituency X doesn't support my party, you're going to go and arrest them and put them in jail because they don't support me. That cannot happen. And the reason that cannot happen is because we have a service commission system which sets up an independent public service. And I say public service, I mean the public service as we know it, the teaching service and the police service, which includes public service, includes the fire service and the prison service. So these service commissions are managed by appointees of the president. So the president in his or her own, I'll say her, because we have a female president and a female to come. So it's safe for me to say her. All are appointed by the president in her own discretion. The chief justice is appointed by the president in her own discretion. The JLSC, the Judicial and Legal Service Commission, which appoints judges in the High Court, they are appointed by the president. And not only judges, but the Director of Public Prosecutions, who has the power to charge anyone or discontinue a prosecution against anyone, is also appointed by the JLSC, which is set up by the president. We have the Elections and Boundaries Commission, for example, which sets constituency boundaries and manages the elections that take place in the country. That person is appointed by the president. So, by far, apart from assisting in the executive function, that is by carrying out the advice of the prime minister, the president also carries out a valuable role in keeping alive and keeping functioning these independent offices, which really give us confidence in our democracy.
Excellent. I like the way you introduced that, because you're right. Certain things we take for granted. For example, the police not being able to arbitrarily arrest persons and so on. That was so good. And I hope it really brings home the point that there is an important role and function that is carried out by the office of the president. Now, we know that we live on an island and the president will travel from time to time. So when the president is not in the country, who acts in the office of the president?
Okay. Well, when the president is not here, there's a line of succession. So first in line to act as president, not only if the president is overseas, but if the president is in Trinidad but unable to perform her functions. So, for example, she falls ill. She has to undergo a surgery that will have her under anesthesia for a few hours. The Constitution allows for someone to act in her stead. So, the first in line to act is the President of the Senate. And this also, in a sense, negatives the argument that the president must be independent of a political party. Because if that was the case, then the person who is acting in the presidency, and the acting president has all the powers of the substantive president. So you can't have somebody holding a political office acting as president if it was a prerequisite that the president be independent of a political party. And we know that the president of the Senate is one of the 16 government senators in the Senate. If the president of the Senate is not available, then the Speaker of the House acts as president. The last time a speaker acted was when Wade Mack was a speaker. He acted for a few days for the president being out of the country. Where the speaker is not available, the vice president of the Senate acts, but he cannot act for more than 7 days. If it is necessary for the vice president to act for more than 7 days, then the deputy speaker must call a meeting of the Electoral College and appoint someone to act as president for beyond the 7 days that the vice president of the Senate will be acting. So that is really the order of succession to the presidency.
At this point, we'll take a quick break and we'll be right back. Welcome back and thank you for staying with us. One before the break, we were having a discussion in terms of the line of succession and persons who would be permitted to act in the office of the president if the president is incapacitated in some form or is outside of the jurisdiction. We want to get into the aspect of removal now. So what are the grounds in the Constitution by which the president may be removed?
The president could be removed for 4 reasons, and of course we call them grounds. If he willfully violates any provision of the Constitution, if he behaves in such a way to bring the office into hatred, ridicule, or contempt, if he behaves in a way that endangers the security of the state, or because of physical or mental incapacity, is unable to carry out the functions of president. So the reason for the removal must be one or more of these grounds.
And what is the procedure for removal?
No, it's a very extensive procedure, a multi-stage procedure to remove the president. And when you when we discuss this procedure, you will see that it's not old talk when we say that it's difficult for a certain government to say, hey, we're going to remove the president if the president, we think that the president is behaving in a way that is bringing the office into contempt, for example. So it's a three-stage process. The first stage is that a motion that the removal of the question of the president's removal ought to be investigated must be adopted by the Electoral College, which is the House of Representatives and the Senate sitting together, a two-thirds majority of the Electoral College must adopt that motion that the removal of the president ought to be investigated. When that motion is adopted, if it is adopted, it means the president is automatically suspended from office. So if he is suspended, then the president of the Senate acts for the period of the suspension. The second stage is a tribunal consisting of the Chief Justice and the four most senior judges must comprise a tribunal and investigate the question of removal. They will then make a report to the Electoral College, which is the House of Representatives and the Senate sitting together. The Senate and the House of Representatives then, after they receive the report, will be summoned by the Speaker to vote on the report. And if two-thirds of the total membership of the House and the Senate votes to remove the president will be removed.
So there are indeed, there are lots of hurdles to be crossed before someone can be removed from the office.
So even getting the motion adopted to start the process is difficult. You would need bipartisan support. Because while a government may have a simple majority in the Electoral College because of their majority in the House and their majority in the Senate, it is in rare cases indeed you will find a situation where the government has a two-thirds majority. It means that you have to at least get one independent, or you have to at least get, and I'm using these numbers loosely, that's not the numbers that you would get, one opposition member to vote with you in order to get the motion adopted. So it's not a done deal. And then let's say a government has all the seats in the House, for example, and this in some countries in the Caribbean that has happened, where the government has all the seats in the House. The second requirement can put a stop to a political witch hunt to get the president out of office. Because now you have the Chief Justice and four of the most senior judges in the country who we take for granted are independent, who carry out judicial functions, which we respect very much. They will then have to investigate and recommend whether or not the president should be removed. And their report, of course, will have carry a lot of weight. So, and if there is a witch hunt, I think the report will say that there's a witch hunt. So there is protections. And then you have to vote again to adopt the report. So, for example, if there's public outcry that what is taking place is not above board, is not proper, then some persons may very well change their votes the second time around when you have to adopt the report for the removal of the president. So she's very, very well protected.
Very well protected. One, as we are getting ready to wrap up, is the office of the president still relevant in 2023?
Definitely so. And I say that for these reasons. One, that it is well accepted in this country that we should have neutral offices. For example, judges must be impartial. We must have neutral people sitting in the service commissions. We must have an independent Elections and Boundaries Commission, for example. And the only way for us to ensure that these offices are not overtly tainted by politics is to maintain the office of the president. Because the alternative is to have an executive president styled after the United States or Guyana, for example. And where we have an executive president, it sounds good. Because when we compare our president with the president of the United States, for example, their duties pale in comparison because the president of the United States is both head of government and head of state. But it works in the United States because you have the separation of powers are rigid in the United States. You have separately elected executive, you have a separately elected legislature, which is the Congress, which holds the other to account. That doesn't take place in Trinidad. So if we have an executive president, unless we change those other portions of the Constitution, the composition of the parliament, for example, you will have the same person sitting as prime minister today exercising all those powers that we say is too much. Also exercising all the important functions of the office of the president. So if we want impartiality and we want this figure that could cross political boundaries and unite the country outside of political party affiliation, then we cannot get that in an executive presidency. And we must appreciate the role that the president serves in the current constitutional framework for what it is, which is a very uniquely Trinidadian office. You'll not find a president with the powers of the president in Trinidad and Tobago anywhere else in the world.
Okay, now, do you have any suggestions for a manner in which the office of the president can be strengthened or augmented? So, for example, if we were to engage in constitutional reform, can you see any way that we can make the president stronger and more robust?
Yes, I think the weak point is at Section 81 of the Constitution, where the president can call on the prime minister to keep him updated on the day-to-day functions of the government. So, for example, cabinet notes he could be presented with. But there's nothing that says that the prime minister must do so, or the prime minister must do so immediately. So if we make it mandatory that the president should be kept informed on a weekly basis, and we spell out what that information would consist of, then we will keep the office of the president grounded in the executive functions of the state as well as the independent duties that they carry out. Another thing that we can do to strengthen the office of president, maybe, and this is what we could model after the United States, when someone is to be appointed, to remove this specter of political affiliation, and that it would somehow interfere with their functioning in the office, is that maybe it's time to consider whether or not we should implement a committee hearing system where the nominees for president will go before a committee of parliament and answer questions from the people's representatives on concerns that the public might genuinely hold about their ability to carry out the functions of president.
One of the things I would like to see implemented, similar to the American system, is where someone who has left the office of president is able to keep their title. So, you know, like President Obama, for example, he has that title for life. Whereas in our system, when someone leaves the office, they lose that title and they go back to their former title. So, I mean, it's just something maybe stylistic or to preserve the status of the individual. But I think that that is a change that should be made.
But Colin, we could fix that ourselves, you know. Nothing is telling us that we must call the person a former president. A practice has grown up where we decided we're going to call the person a former president. To me, once a president, always a president. Once a prime minister, always a prime minister.
Well, this has been a great conversation. Thank you very much for taking the time.
It was indeed a pleasure for me, and I hope I was able to bring some education to your listeners. And of course, please feel free if I could be of assistance in the future. Please let me know.
Thank you for listening to the Legal Corner podcast series. For more information, please visit us at our Facebook or Instagram pages or send your comments to thelegalcornerpodcast@gmail.com. We look forward to hearing from you.